to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's Community Radio Station.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on the land of Homelco First Nation in Campbell River, BC.
I'm your host, Bill Williams.
And I'm Deanna Paul.
In this episode,
a systematic dehumanization of the Palestinian people.
He died believing that the RCMP was investigating and that he had no future as a researcher.
But first, here are the headlines.
The Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, CRTC, has again fired its Ontario Commissioner, Raj Shoen. Commissioner Shoen was appointed to the CRTC in 2013 for a five-year term and is one of only two racialized commissioners to have ever been appointed to the CRTC in its long 48-year history. However, in June 2016, Commissioner Shoen was dismissed from his position on very vague grounds that suggested a larger issue of systemic racism within the CRTC. The reasons for Commissioner Shoen's initial dismissal was not publicly disclosed, but was widely believed to be related to the ongoing legal action between Shoen and CRTC Chairman Jean-Pierre Blais. Documents filed in Shoen's legal challenge to his initial dismissal alleged a toxic environment of overt racism within the CRTC, enforced through a culture of fear and intimidation. Shoen argued that a racist double standard was used in handling harassment allegations against him as compared to a white commissioner who he alleged referred to him as a, quote, spoiled rich brown kid who probably grew up with servants, requested to change hotels on a commission-sanctioned travel because there were too many, quote, black people, and complained that it smelled like curry in her office after meeting with ethnic broadcasters. Shoen challenged his initial dismissal in federal court, and last week, Justice Cecily Strickland ruled he was not treated fairly since he was fired before the judge threw out the harassment investigation, and thus could not determine if Shoen's dismissal was conducted with procedural fairness since Cabinet did not indicate how much it based its decision on the questionable harassment investigation. But just 4 days after being reinstated to his position as commissioner, Shoen was again fired this past Thursday without a face-to-face meeting with Canadian Heritage, the ministry that is responsible for the CRTC. In a statement, Shoen noted that he has again been denied procedural fairness as he was not given a chance to discuss the alleged reasons for his dismissal. Additionally, Shoen said he will be challenging the dismissal in federal court and initiating other actions to ensure accountability and justice.
Renters in Toronto Parkdale neighborhood have been on a rent strike to pressure their landlord Medicap Living to withdraw its above-guideline rent increase applications and to complete the hundreds of outstanding repair requests in the building. CKUW's People of Interest brings us to this headline.
All right, I'm joined on the line by Cole Weber. He's a community legal worker with the Parkdale Community Legal Services. And we're going to talk about the Parkdale rent strike, which began on Monday, May 1st. That's in Toronto.
Parkdale is one of the densest urban neighborhoods in the country. 90% of people in Parkdale are renters. It's the neighborhood in Toronto where people spend the largest proportion of their income on rent, up around 50%. And it's one of the last working class and immigrant neighborhoods in and around downtown Toronto. The tenants have two demands. The first is that Metcap withdraw the six above guideline rent increase applications at the buildings in Parkdale. And two, that Metcap immediately do the repairs in the units. So for the past few years, there has been an uptick in tenant struggles against landlords in Parkdale. So a couple of years ago, tenants successfully organized and fought a predatory landlord that moved into the neighborhood and bought up five buildings called Achilles, Swedish-based firm. And so the organizing today builds off of those recent struggles and expands upon those and is now taking on the biggest and worst corporate landlord in the neighborhood.
Since 2000, Free Speech Radio News has been a vital part of the American and international grassroots and community news landscape, providing factual reports on important international and U.S. domestic news stories often missing in the corporate press and amplifying the voices of the ignored and unheard. The FSRN's news programming has been broadcast on radio stations across the U.S. for 17 years, but it all came to an end late last month after FSRN was unable to raise the funds needed to stay on the air. In late 2013, the program ran out of funding after their main client and distributor fell months behind and then defaulted on payments. During the silence, a skeleton team retooled and a few months later relaunched as FSRN, the weekly edition, but even the bare-bones weekly operations came to a price that FSRN was no longer able to pay, and it ran out its last weekly show on April 28th. Free Speech Radio News was founded when a group of reporters went on strike against the Pacifica Radio Network in 2000. The strikers said management was censoring coverage of internal politics at the flagship community radio organization. Independent radio stations across the country supported the strike by airing the daily newscasts. FSRN became a worker-run collective and pioneered the decentralized newsroom model, with production staff in different cities around the world rather than concentrated in media hubs like New York or Washington, D.C. Stay tuned to Groundwires, where in our next episode we will bring you the voices and history of FSRN, which was an inspiration for news broadcastings like ours.
That's it for headlines. You're listening to Groundwire Community Radio. We'll be right back after this. It's time for our feature stories. On Friday, April 28th, a solidarity vigil was held in support of Palestinian hunger strikers in front of the Israeli consulate in Montreal. The strike was launched on April 17th with more than 1,500 Palestinians prisoners currently hunger striking. The strikers have a list of demands that include an end to the denial of family visits, the right of health care, right to education, an end to solitary confinement, and abolishing administrative detention, imprisonment without charge or trial. Laith Marouf brings us this report from CKUT in Montreal.
You're here demonstrating in front of the Israeli consulate downtown Montreal in Westmount Square. Can you tell us about yourself and why you're here?
Well, I'm here to be in solidarity with Palestinian political prisoners on hunger strike. I'm Palestinian, and I'm also part of a Palestine solidarity group, Tadama.
My name is Sabine Friesinger. I'm a member of Palestinian and Jewish Unity, the group here in Montreal. We hold pickets every Friday between 12 and noon. That's one of our main action that we do. We do this for several years we did it in front of the Israeli consulate when it was on Peel and René Lévesque, and then they moved. They were scared of our pickets, basically. That's what we think, anyways. They moved to Westmount. So now here we're at Westmount between 12 and 1 every week. This particular one was in solidarity with the Palestinian prisoner, the strike, the hunger strike that the prisoners in Palestine are doing, and we're just standing, answering, being in solidarity with them, and also trying to spread the word about the action that they are taking, which is a very serious action to be deciding not, you know, to not feed yourself in protest in face of an apartheid regime that is completely ignoring Palestinian human rights, the rights, and seeing Palestinians as humans fully. So that's why we're here today, and we're continuing this until the hunger strike continues. You know, as long as it goes, basically, we'll be here in front of every Friday in front of the Israeli consulate. It's interesting to see the reaction of people on the street. We have some people that are, you know, very, very angry about what our message. But then we also have a lot of support, and the support is growing. I would say over the years, as we've been flyering, and you know, as the public, the opinion of the public has changed and is changing on Palestine.
The conditions of the Palestinian prisoners, the numbers. What can you tell us about those? This is probably important for our listeners.
There are actually 6,500 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, and 58 of them are women. 300 of them are children. You can imagine imprisoning children, which is what Israel does. Also tortures them systematically. 500 of those prisoners are what we call administrative detainees. That is, they've been arrested under a law which permits administrative detention. They can be picked right up off the street. There's no proof, no formal charges, no habeas corpus, no trial, no presentation in front of the court. And this is a law which is renewable every 6 months, so they can actually be in prison indefinitely with no rights. 1,800 of those prisoners also suffer from various diseases, and some of them are chronic diseases, and they don't receive the medical attention that is necessary. So, also the question of family visits, the question of overcrowding in jails. They're asking for air conditioning. You know how hot it is in the Middle East, especially in the summer. Overcrowded cells, lack of air conditioning, simply a complete lack of the basic human conditions that are necessary for people to live at least with some sense of dignity. Because
that is why the Palestinians are calling it the dignity hunger strike.
Absolutely, because what we're dealing with here is just a systematic dehumanization, of the Palestinian people, and that shows itself not only in the conditions in which they're forced to live in Israeli prisons, but just in general.
Thank you to Laith Maruf for that report.
The Worldwide March for Science was held for the first time on April 22nd to coincide with the annual Earth Day. Chris Cook of CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria went down to the Victoria March for Science, held in solidarity with other marchers around the world. About 750 Victorians braved the cool and rainy weather to show their support for science and the freedom of scientists to communicate their findings, regardless of those findings, political inconvenience, and to work without fear of losing their jobs or research grants by making public the conclusions of their study.
It's April 22nd. Here I am in Victoria, down at Centennial Square, where the City Hall is. April 22nd is Earth Day. This year, throughout cities in North America, there's a March for Science going on. We saw this in Canada a few years ago when Stephen Harper was shutting down inquiry into especially energy-related science. The same is going on under President Trump now in the U.S. They're following Canada's lead to some degree. No, I know. Here I'm looking at somebody standing here in a lab coat. There is no planet B or no plan B either, of course. Yeah. Can you tell me who you are and why you're here?
I'm Jay, and I'm a student at UVic in biology. And, well, I mean, of course, science is important. And both Canada and the U.S. have a history of trying to muzzle scientists. So if we can stop that, it's going to be good for everyone.
Well, I know this started during Harper. Is it the same now with Trudeau, or have things changed in Canada?
I'm honestly not quite sure about how the situation for scientists has changed under Trudeau, but I do know that the situation in general has escalated because of Trump gaining American presidency. He's been making a lot of moves to silence the scientists there, and so everybody is kind of trying to take a stand against that.
Well, thanks a lot.
Yep. The next speaker has a very unusual story to tell. It is Rebecca Warburton from the School of Public Admin up at UVic.
My student, Roderick McIsaac, paid the highest price. He killed himself December 8th, 2012. Devastated by the loss of his PhD and his future career. Excuse me. Sadly, we read in the Ombudsman's report, just released, that 11 days before that, the ministry had done an internal review and they had determined that he had not misused health data and he should not have been fired. And they never bothered to tell him. He died believing that the RCMP was investigating and that he had no future as a researcher.
The future of science obviously completely depends on young people, and to that end, we have two wonderful students from Mount Doug Secondary School right here in Victoria, Inez Verdun and Sophie Collins.
Without the access I've had to innovation and research discovered through science, I couldn't imagine how different my life would be. And no, I'm not talking about something like not having my smartphone anymore. I'm talking about how science has helped me make decisions like using less plastic and cutting meat out of my diet. And how it's helped me to realize that the choices I make every day have a big effect, not just on our local ecosystems, but on the whole world.
So as advertised, the throng, and it has become one, I estimated somewhere in the neighborhood of 750 or more people, eventually a lot of signs, a good cross-section of ages. And this under a day that hasn't been spring-like at all. It's been raining pretty heavily early in the day, and it's still a little bit chilly. There's some great puppets leading the parade, and a huge white elephant for the, representing Site C. And they're all going to make their way down Government Street to the legislature forthwith.
Yeah.
NPR's Community Radio News. Now it's time for our Community Radio Report, brought to us by Fannie Hay and Catherine Crocher of CFRT 107.3 FM and Iqaluit, Nunavut.
The Future of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Broadcasting Initiative aims to bring practitioners, policy makers, and academics together as allies to prepare a context for respectful and meaningful consultation on the CRTC's reviewing the Native Broadcasting Policy. The Future of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Broadcasting Initiative has been holding gatherings across the country and will culminate in a national gathering in mid-June in Ottawa. So far, gatherings have been held in Winnipeg, Iqaluit, Edmonton, and Campbell River, BC, and will be in Halifax later this month. On April 12th, the regional gathering was held in Iqaluit, Nunavut, where participants were able to discuss the challenges and success of First Nations broadcasting in the North. Here are some excerpts from the gathering, starting with Elder Jack Anawak and Minister of Nunavut Territory Assembly. We then hear from Claude Grenier, former executive director of Takamit Nipingat, Inc., and Inuktitut Radio Network. Madeleine D. Argencourt, president of Inuit Broadcasting Corporations. Fannie Hay, radio coordinator, and CFRT 107.3, the Francophone community radio station in Iqaluit. And TV Nunavut Board of Directors, co-chair Charlotte DeWolf.
Community radio stations allow people to tell their stories, to mirror the concerns of the population, to focus on the key topics that they are interested in, and to increase understanding through information sharing on any given subject. The elders speak of passing on the information verbally. Radio allows for storytelling with the emphasis on length that teach appropriate behaviors, that talk of overcoming great struggles and articulate Inuit values and beliefs that are just as applicable today. Sharing information, particularly to our youth, is another way for young people to develop Inuit pride in being able to survive in the toughest environment in the world.
So you run a network for years and years, and then from one day to another, you're being told, oh, you were cut by so. In the last 5 years, we have an average cut of 17.2%. So you hire people, and the following year, you say, oh, we're in trouble. In 2016, 2017, we had some drastic decision to make. We had to cut and provide the same service. I don't know if there's any other radio stations in Canada that can do it. For Native, it's like from one day to another, it's just normal.
The Northern Broadcasting Policy from 1983, we feel, should be reviewed and updated. Many issues remain. All institutions, government bodies should include Aboriginal representation, and that includes the CRTC, who I've met with several times. And see one brown face there. Telefilm, CMF, Canada Council, NFB, and CBC. Consultation would be on a regular basis, and it should be on a regular basis. Consultation should take place also in the North, and unfortunately that has not been happening as much as we would like to see. One thing I don't know if it was mentioned this morning that we're really happy about is TV Nunavut. IBC first put forward a concept of creating a regional television network for Nunavut, and during the process leading up to the government of Nunavut's Inuit Language Protection Act. Along with Nunavut independent producers, we had formed an organization working towards the creation of such a network to promote our languages. And we anticipate that within 2 years we'll launch this service, the TV Nunavut. And TV Nunavut programming will primarily be in Inuit language, supporting one of the goals of the Inuit Language Protection Act. And having our language available in the home, at work, and at school is really important to us.
Now I have to talk a little bit about the policy now from CRTC. So when I came into function and I started to work on January, I did a lot of research, reading all these, you know, tons of papers from CRTC, which is like a pain in the ass. Sorry, but sometimes they don't make things easy, you know, to understand. And so I just took the phone and I called them directly. And I said, I need some information. So we're a Francophone radio station. We have to produce mainly in French. But I'm wondering if we can do some ads in Inuktitut. And program officer who was on the phone with me, she said, well, your license doesn't permit you to produce any ad in Inuktitut or in English. It's only in French. But in Nunavut, we're like maybe 800 Francophones. So it's getting harder for me, you know, to get some ads in French.
An audience survey was commissioned in March 2016 by TV Nunavut to examine the level of support throughout Nunavut to establish an educational television broadcasting channel to deliver made for Nunavut or versioned programming to strengthen the Inuit languages, Inuit culture, and regional identity. Respondents to the survey strongly supported the development of content that is currently not available through the over 500 English and French channels in Nunavut. While radio fills a gap in Inuktitut language content and provides a source of information, TV Nunavut would be able to provide rich information to reach all ages and learning needs. We see television in Nunavut as a vital tool to help strengthen language use in the home and community, which is at the root of language and cultural revitalization.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by participants at the Homalco First Nations Indigenous Radio Conference.
Headlines this week were written by Omi Sama Rahim Tula. We thank all our contributors this week, as well as Gretchen King and Carly Forbes. Tune in again to hear Groundwires on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.